All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about, and this I talk about in the book, cultural stories about marriage that reflect what emerging adults tend to think today. First, it's a very popular idea that there is no rush, right? We definitely saw that in the early slides, right? I mean, now we're at the upper 80s percentage of 20 to 24-year-olds who have never been married, right? And I'm not necessarily problematizing that, but I'm saying they think there is no rush, okay? And sometimes there's this sense of, wow, if marriage is going to be for good, for life, and people still want to marry and stay married, and life expectancies are like 80 now, that's a long time to spend with one person. So that thought intimidates some people, more men than it does women. Although, as most of us know, the statistics within marriage suggest that men tend to like it better than women do. So there's no rush. The second cultural story is you need to be your own person. And you just aren't your own person, apparently, at age 20 or 23 or maybe even 25. So the 20s, and to a lesser extent the 30s, are a time when people tend to think, this is the time to figure out who you are. It's a cultural mantra. Figuring out who you are obviously takes time. And marriage, to many, feels like it's like a full-time job or something. You have to stack it on top of your career concerns. I mean, it's hard work. So, just to quote one of the young women in the study, her name is Clara. She articulated this identity formation argument pretty well. She said, I think the main thing is making sure that you are your own person. Because I know people who are getting married, and this is sophomore year of college, I'm like, you're not your own person. You're going to have some major changes. And, you know, if at the end of 10 years after this, if they're going to be, you don't even know if they're going to be the same person you married. If you'll be the same person. So just make sure that you're your own person. That way you're ready to present yourself to someone else. It's a very confusing narrative. What does it mean to be one's own person? What does it mean to change? It's confusing, but it's compelling to a lot of people, right? A lot of people think that they don't know who they are, what they want, and that the purpose of dating and relationships in the 20s is to figure out what you like, okay? So the 20s and maybe the early 30s are for experimentation. Later on is for the stable set of preferences. Because young adults tend to think they will change what they like, change what they want, right? And that they honestly think that most of that change is going to be right in the 20s, okay? I don't know that the evidence is sure that the 20s are the only time we change, right? But like I said, I'm not defending these mentalities. I'm saying this is sort of cultural narratives about how emerging adults are thinking about and delaying marriage. Third, next slide, please, is they think it's too soon to have children, okay? Numerous interviewees responded to our question, why do you want to get married, with an answer that went something like this. Oh, I want to have children. Many middle-class emerging adults equate marriage with children. It's almost as if there's an older pre-contraceptive era mentality that hasn't died. I mean, the pill, like it or not, opened up opportunities for new aspirations to be fulfilled prior to parenting, okay? You could marry and then not automatically have children. But in the mentality of a lot of emerging adults, like, you marry and then you start having children. It's all part of a package deal in their mind. Obviously, though, this resists the idea of peak fertility that we talked about a little bit earlier. It's a biological reality, which seems to aggravate a lot of emerging adults, right? Many of them don't want to think about it, don't want to talk about it. Many of them don't understand fertility. Okay? We don't teach fertility. I take it upon myself to teach intro to sociology students just a wee bit about fertility because they need to know. It's hard to believe that. And this is not just Texas, believe me. And when I look at the religious side of the equation, the religious emphasis seems to be more on sex, less on fertility. Next slide, please. Another cultural story that's popular is the 20s is the time to travel, which is sort of consonant with that freedom narrative. Now is the time for freedom, exploration, experimentation. Why exactly the desire to travel is presumed to interrupt or undermine romantic relationships that are on their way to marriage is unclear to me, but it remains a very common theme, right? We heard about it even from people who clearly did not have the means to travel, okay? It's just the idea of it, together with the assumption that marriage nixes travel possibilities. It's as if marriage means children, it means work, a mortgage on the house in the suburbs, and the end of all things creative and spontaneous. Things like world travel. On the other hand, I don't know about you, but marriage expanded my financial resources. It didn't contract them. It reduces expenses. We split things. And it opened up the possibility of travel in a way that being single didn't. Emerging adults also don't really recognize that this travel narrative is competitive with their sort of career-building narrative, right? I mean, who has the time to go take a three-week vacation? When I was in graduate school and my wife was working full-time at a job, she got 2 weeks a year to travel. And, you know, those 2 weeks have got to be spent visiting your parents, okay? So there's a little understanding that the travel possibilities are much better later in life than they are typically when you're in your 20s trying to build your career. Next slide, please. There's a lot of parental resistance, and I think this is a profoundly influential thing. Parents are powerful and effective. If young adults are rebellious, they're certainly not rebelling against their parents in this domain. Parental warnings about marriage tend to work. One of my graduate school colleagues published an article in a top sociology journal. She evaluated data from 341 women between the ages of 27 and 30. Okay. She noted that with each incremental increase in the mother's preferred age of marriage for her daughter, so this was information both on what the daughter had done or not done, and what her parents or her mother thought about, with each incremental increase of her mother wanting her to wait, she waited. The odds that her daughter would actually be married at the time had dipped 23% for each incremental unit increase in her mother wishing for her to wait. So what parents say matters, even into adulthood. So they're telling us, finish your college, finish your graduate school, launch your career, become financially independent, don't become dependent on a spouse. Those things take a good deal of time. And another interesting thing to note is the people who marry without ever having cohabited are the least likely to ever have gotten financial assistance from their parents. It's interesting. So we're more likely to subsidize people who don't marry or people who cohabit than we are to subsidize marriage. In part because we think marriage is the end of, I mean, your dependence on us as a family. I get that. I don't know that it's necessarily always a helpful thing. Because we say, you've got to accomplish these things first, and those things take a good deal of time. Next slide, please. Another powerful cultural narrative out there today is, you must find sexual chemistry. Okay? This is probably a byproduct in part of our scientific emphasis on matching today. And we've extended that match business into the bedroom. So chemistry is not just how well you get along, the conversations you enjoy, the hobbies you might share, religious commitments, political commitments, or shared ideas for the future. chemistry is about how complimentary you are in the bedroom. Is there sustained erotic attention? Does she do what he likes? Does he know how to please her? Are their sex drives comparable? Although sustained sexual chemistry takes time and requires real talking, many young adults believe it's supposed to emerge silently, rapidly, with the commencement of a sexual relationship. If it doesn't, or if the sex is awkward, or if the partner doesn't like the same things you like, a lot of people think that's a sign that sexual chemistry just isn't there and won't exist. Now, finding out whether you have sexual chemistry with someone precludes waiting very long to have sex. The presumption among many is that if the sex is bad, it probably won't get better, and continuing the relationship is a waste of time, which is why many emerging adults think it's a profoundly bad idea to avoid sex before marriage. Plenty of us think abstinence is a good thing, and that statistically it suggests, it's correlated with a stronger marriage and a more lasting marriage. Abstinence, in the minds of many, is a risk factor for divorce. So many emerging adults, except for the most religious ones, sense that it's a risk. To wait and see about sexual chemistry could reveal that it doesn't exist and perhaps can't exist. So they think that if you abstain until marriage, you're going to then reveal and seal poor sexual chemistry. And they think that marriage can't possibly last. But it doesn't work that way. Back to my graduate school colleague's study. She found that the more premarital partners this group of young women had, the smaller chance that they reported being married. But the chemistry thing is a powerful mentality. Again, a lot of these things thwart the data, but it doesn't really matter because the power of a compelling narrative just sort of blows past data in most people's minds. Next slide, please. Finally, there's the deflated confidence in the institution. I know we esteem it a lot, but at some level, plenty of people don't trust it. Okay? The non-marital birth rate, we know, is skyrocketing. And in the United States, among 20 to 24-year-olds, used to be a peak marriage time, the non-marital birth rate climbed from 20% to 60% in the span of just under 30 years. Okay? I know it's about 41%, but among that age segment, it's 60%, which is not a gentle slope. That's a huge mountain of change, suggesting we're not so sure about marriage. We don't think it's such a good idea. In fact, we're more opposed to it than to having a baby outside marriage. That is a less... that can accidentally happen, but it takes some... You can't accidentally get married. And so people are very hesitant about marriage sometimes. That drop in confidence seems most pronounced among poorer and less educated Americans. So this institution that we know keeps Americans from being indigent and dependent on state assistance is being shunned in some ways by the group that would most benefit from it, and that is discouraging. Next slide. So some of us wonder, is marriage deinstitutionalizing? Well, not if we think of deinstitutionalizing as disappearing. Okay? It is not disappearing. It does seem to be trying to find its way. So we have non-marital childbearing eroded the norms about marriage as the primary place for raising children. Cohabitation has eroded the norms about marital sex as the only place for legitimate sex. Changes in women's labor force participation, household divisions of labor, no-fault divorce advent, and the prospect or the realization in some places of gay marriage. All of these things sort of, they deinstitutionalize, they change what we think about marriage. Now, stating all that implies nothing about the wisdom of any of those things, but frankly, we have wanted most of those things, and giving a voting chance, most people will affirm those things, but they've come at a cost, generating what sociologists call unintended consequences. We want some things, we want marriage, and yet the institution of marriage thrives in settings that we have voted against at plenty of opportunities. Next slide, please. We also have sort of what we call the disappearing marriage naturalist. This is from a study about by Maria Kafelis, a sociologist, I believe, at St. Joseph's University. So now, as I've said, the story of marriage is pushed later into the 20s, into the 30s, in part because most of us are becoming marriage planners, not professionally, but we think of marriage as something that has to be plotted, planned, and not naturalists, right? Marriage naturalists have a far more modest set of requirements for marriage. Once they're attained, building a life together seems more preferable to the marriage planner's preference for pursuing life goals individually. Okay? The naturalists seem to take marriage for granted. It's just the thing you do when you've been with somebody for a while. The planners think of marriage as a product. Marriage is something you earn, you work towards, less so as a producer. Marriage is something that produces something. That's a naturalist approach. So when we see cohabitation, we see non-marital childbearing, and premarital relationships, she considers these things as placeholders, right, for marriage among planners. Placeholders. We do those things, and they're keeping us on the pathway towards marriage. For naturalists, on the other hand, commitment is not something they fret about, think about, endlessly analyze, or fret over. It's as if we love choices, but we actually hate choosing. Next slide. Some research I've done on religion in early marriage shows that it's a pretty strong effect, especially among men. Men among whom the importance of religion is the most important thing in their life are far more apt to have become married by age 24 than men who think it's not that important. And it's a stronger, obviously, this barely matters at all to women in this domain. But it's a key predictor of men's interest in marriage. And it does raise the question at some level, is marriage going to become increasingly a religious thing? Are fidelity and monogamy at bottom religious issues? I cannot answer that one today. One thing I tend to observe is that previously, and I'm not going back to a glorious past, but there were multiple institutions in society that channeled people towards marriage. And now it's just not that way. I mean, religious institution is, I wouldn't say it's alone, but it's certainly the primary institution pressing people forward towards marriage. In conclusion, I want to peer into the future just a little bit. Here's what I think is going to happen. These are educated guesses, and I'm just speculating on some of these things. I do think that at the age at marriage rise will taper off. I think there are ceilings beyond which countries will not go. It does appear to be self-limiting. The proportion of people, however, who are married is continuing to decline. I think that will continue to decline. As a result, we're going to see marriage rates decline, as we saw up there for Canada, and divorce rates will also tumble. Okay? So under current U.S. law, I suspect divorce rates will always track with marriage rates. Right? This is why you hear states like Massachusetts say, hey, our divorce rates are low. Look at Oklahoma, look at Arkansas, what's wrong with them? Because marriage rates and divorce rates under current law will just always track together. I do think the popularity of stay-at-home fathers, I've been asked about this before, will quickly hit a ceiling. I mean, women seem to be thriving in this kind of economy, and men in the United States, especially working-class men, aren't so much. Sort of this suggestions, well, maybe there'll be just a stay-at-home dad phenomena. I don't think that will ever become really popular. I think that'll quickly hit a ceiling. Next to last, fertility is declining. Intergenerational relations will suffer, in part due to this growing age gap between grandparents and grandchildren. If we are waiting to marry, and then if our children wait to marry, but you know, hey, maybe we'll live to 80 years old. But I know we didn't wait to marry, but our my in-laws had my wife a little bit late in life, and now none of my children have a grandfather, right? Which is kind of frustrating. I think that will only increase in frequency, in part because if multiple generations wait to marry and to have children, we'll see that age gap increase, and intergenerational relations will suffer. Some may wonder whether the higher fertility of cultural conservatives will win out in the end. Okay, some people say cultural conservatives are more likely to have children. I'm not so sure. There's a lot about modern life that turns people into pragmatists, planners, and delayers. Finally, in the U.S. at least, and perhaps in Canada, we have the idea of moral hazard. Okay, growing independence on the state. Okay, once it exists, it's very difficult to undo. And arguments about it retain a moral sense to them. Social Security, healthcare debates, etc. But we are becoming dependent as individuals on the state. Okay, and since independence from marriage seems increasingly more than a personal choice, it seems like a right. Right? People talk about, I'll notice this in media accounts, especially with the Great Recession, people said, would describe stories of people who were, you know, had to move in with their parents, or, and they always sort of said, well, so-and-so was divorced. And I keep thinking, divorce, I mean, is not like a passive condition. It's something that people make happen. But there's a sense that you just shouldn't have to marry in order to do X, Y, and Z. So I'm going to stop there and take questions, and more of this you can learn about in the book if you want. Thanks.